You're listening to a sermon by Ron Reed, recorded on Sunday, September 6, 2009, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I guess we could have a little bit of light so people can see. So, what did you see? What did you notice? Somebody back there actually observed something. What did you see happen?
It was whoa.
Yeah, that was whoa, wasn't it? Did you say something about the water changed? I thought I heard someone say this.
Oh, she said something about it, like a tree.
Like a tree?
Yeah.
Interesting. What else did you notice? What else did you see?
I'm always fascinated by how stone gets corroded by eternal the water. And whenever I see rock that's being, you can just tell it's ancient. It's like the beautiful patterns of wear.
And you can see that in these stones? Each one has its own texture, its own...
It's like soft and swirly. And then other parts are hard. And it's hard stuff and then the beautiful patterns of wear. And
I love in this the texture of each one of those stones. You set it on there and you're going, that peculiar shape and texture and weight and color and the sound when it gets set there is particular. It's marvelous. Who stops to look at all that shale on the beach? But each one's lifted up and placed.
I was struck by the flatness of all the stones. You don't normally see stones that are that wide and flat at a beach. And obviously that's a different terrain than what we have here, but the flatness and just that you could find these big flat stones on a beach was pretty neat.
Very particular to the place.
Yeah.
I was struck by the fact that the materials were so durable, yet the structure was so fragile. Mm-hmm. It just literally disappeared in an instant.
Yeah. Oh, and when it goes... What a deflation, what a feeling. And then his whole body goes, like with the stones. Just.
Well, and you get the sense like, well, how can this be an act of art? And then the next instant you see this beautiful shape. And that's when she literally went, whoa.
Yeah.
It's astounding.
It is astounding.
And indeed, those cones will stand for years. And that one, I don't know how long that particular one stood. Sometimes they don't last as long, but... The tide comes in, the tide goes out, all that, and then they'll stay there for a long time. And the one in the forest, I bet it would last even longer, or in the glade or whatever that was. Yeah, but what a juxtaposition, isn't it, between the fragility and impermanence of the thing, because it's built to fall apart, and yet it's out of stone, and it's just wonderful.
I was reminded in British Columbia we love water, and especially. You go to the Gulf Islands on a ferry, there was an inscription that I found meaningful. In time, water erodes everything, even boredom.
Even what?
Boredom.
Oh, boredom!
Well, Andy Goldsworthy would agree with that, I think. That's quite wonderful. Quite wonderful. Let's see. Oblation is really the theme that we're talking today, and it was Lauren Wilkinson at Regent College who introduced this idea to me through a book called An Offering of Uncles, which is about the priesthood of Adam and the shape of the world. Robert Farrah Capon was, I think still is, an Episcopal priest or an Anglican priest. And in the section about oblation, which really has shaped my whole understanding of the art that I make, the art that I see and listen to and read, he uses this central idea of oblation. In a high church, in a high Anglican church or a high Catholic church, there will come a moment in the service before what we would call the Lord's Supper or communion or the Eucharist or whatever word we might use for it in our different traditions, but the taking of the bread and the wine. Before that, the bread and wine on the altar have been bread and wine. That's what they are. And they might in some traditions, be, you know, flat little wafers with no yeast in them. They might be real wine, they might be grape juice, they might be whatever. They are, even in those high traditions, they are just bread and wine, even though they might look fancy and have the cross imprinted on them. There comes a moment in the service where the priest takes the cup and he takes the bread. And he might do them both at once, and sometimes he does each one separately. And he takes it, and the first thing he says is he thanks God for this common element, plain old wine, plain old bread. And we don't even think of wine. We think of wine as something special and fancy for a special occasion, some of us now. That was what people drank. Even water could be suspect, but wine would be safe to drink, and that's what people drank. Jesus chose the most common possible element for this. And the priest takes it and first says, thank you. So sees this and basically says, behold, it is good. Thank you. Offers it to God and says a prayer of offering. So it's from thank you to an offering back to God, who is the giver first of all things. And then the prayer that prepares this to be used now for the Lord's Supper. When that comes down, sometimes when it's up there, there'll be in the highest churches a ringing of bells to signify the moment has happened. After that, you don't take this bread home after if there's some left over and have peanut butter sandwiches. The wine can't be, you know, passed out with the tea and coffee at the church social afterwards. It's now consecrated, set aside. It's special. And indeed, in those high churches, it's believed it's actually transformed. There are not many Catholics in the world who actually think that if you did a chemical experiment on that, that would now be flesh and blood. But in every sense but the chemical one, they would say that is the Lord's body and blood. Many other traditions say, no, it's symbolic, it's a metaphor. But even so, at that point, you're not gonna toss that in the trash without thinking. It's something special. It's being set apart, hasn't it? That oblation, behold, it is good. Thank you. And now it's a new thing. It's going to be used for a new purpose. And it's... is it more sacred? Has its sacredness come out? Is it blessed? Was it blessed before? It's certainly blessed now. And then the community gathers and eats this meal together. Stopping to recognize the body. That's why Paul was angry at the Corinthians, because some ate and drank without recognizing. I'm going to read you a piece that Capon wrote about oblation. I take my children to the beach. On the north shore of Long Island, this is a pretty stony proposition. The mills of the gods grind coarsely here. But in exchange for bruised feet and a sore tailbone, they provide gravel for the foundation of the arts. Every year we hunt for perfect stones, ovals, spheroids, lozenges, eggs. By the end of the summer, there are pebbles all over the house. They have no apparent use other than the delight they provide to us. But that is the whole point of the collection. The very act of hunting them is an introduction to the oblation of things. Look at this one. Do you think it'll split evenly enough for arrowheads? What color is that one when it's wet? Lick it and see. Daddy wants a big, flat, round one to hold the sauerkraut under the brine. Will this one do? We walk down the beach, lifting stones into our history. We are collectors, in-gatherers of being. Humans are the lover of textures, colors, shapes. The only creature in the whole world that knows a good pickling stone when we see one. Now the arts go way beyond that, but that is where they begin. The child who runs the satin binding of his blanket between his fingers, the boy who carefully oils his collection of ball bearings so they will not rust, the woman who loves to handle thick braids, the man who opens his pocket knife just to hear the satisfying click with which it closes. All of these are priestly builders. It's in our simplest oblations that we are at our historical best. When we rise higher, we make more mistakes. We diagram and spiritualize what should sometimes just be offered and loved and offered as a thing. But these low levels were mostly a success. The world has seen few badly offered blanket bindings, few profaned ball bearings. As long as we can hunt stones, we'll know the fire of our priesthood has not gone out. So there's some grist for the mill as we look at our next clip. This clip is about two men who are at the center of this next story. Augie Wren owns a smoke shop in Brooklyn. It's a little shop on the corner where you can buy Havana cigars, even though they're illegal in America, but he has the best ones. And the community just gathers. They get their smokes, they get their magazines. There's, popsicles and a few things like that there. Mostly they come to talk baseball, they come to talk movies, they come to talk life. And it's just this little place on the corner of this intersection. The other character you'll meet is Paul. Paul is a writer who is unable to write. He was a novelist, fairly prolific one, until the day that his wife stepped out into traffic and was killed by a car. And Paul, since that time, has really not been able to write. He tries, lives alone in the apartment that they shared, walks the streets of the neighborhood where they live, hangs around the smoke shop because there's people there and things happening, but that's about the extent of his life. And then one night, just as Augie's smoke shop is closing, he runs out of, and I don't know enough about tobacco to know what special kind of tobacco this is that he wants at midnight, probably some exotic cigar or pipe tobacco, and he comes and just catches Augie as he's closing. What did you see? What did you hear? What was there? What did you notice?
It's like our house has been noise, Mr. The constant, no matter how close we might be with someone, there's this sort of this background, like the ocean before, sort of this background of stuff,
Traffic, the street. Well, like the ocean in the one before, that's a nice observation.
It's soothing after a while. People complain about it in the city. It's like, you go, oh, now you mention it.
Yeah. But it's my corner after all. Yeah. That's the sound of where he is. Isn't it? But yeah, you're right. It's always present. Like the ocean in the other one. That's good. Yeah.
He's, Augie isn't in a hurry, both in looking at the pictures, but also when he was closing up, he's willing to take the time to go back in and spend time with somebody.
The transfiguration in terms of context, the idea that suddenly realizes it's his wife, who's no longer there, but for this one individual, it changes everything.
Yeah.
Dramatically.
What a moment, eh, when he sees her. Yeah.
I don't know the rest of the movie, but does that spark his ability to write again? Or, well, I guess you don't want to ruin it.
No, I hate giving things away.
Okay.
But this is a transition point for him. This is a moment. Stories are about things that happen to people and then what they do as a result. And then when they try to do that thing, something happens, and therefore they have to do this other thing. It's like a series of dominoes falling. That's how stories are told. And so, in fact, as you intuited, does this mean that exactly? What happens next? What happens next? And this does signify in the story, but you'll have to read it to see how. Other things you saw in there, heard, picked up in the dialogue, the music. Did anyone notice the soundtrack? What was there? What was the sound?
Piano.
I thought Ruth was playing.
What's that?
I thought Ruth was playing.
Ruth? Was that right? Yeah. One note. That's right. I think it's a Bach invention. Or maybe a fugue, but it's just a note, a simple another note. Just the simplicity about it.
I saw inner exploration and reflection.
Mm-hmm. In which character? Both characters?
In the one that was looking at the picture.
The writer, Paul. And you. Boy, it's a lovely little performance on his part, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You see him move from, well, okay, to, it's overwhelming. Those are all the same. And I love the moment the next book comes out. I was like, slow down, my friend.
What is it?
And then he slows down, pays attention, and starts to, again, transform and absorb this. And then he sees his wife. So all that, all those things, that transformation happens in him just from the simple act of taking time to look at his photographs. There's something over here.
It might, well, it's kind of connected to what was said already, but the unexpected that opens up information or opens up or reveals something that he thought he knew the tobacconist, and just seeing that camera says, oh, this person isn't. I had him in a box, and he's not in the box I thought he was in. And that opened up a whole, it was an entry into a deeper relationship.
Yes. Yeah. Disrupts his perception. The world's a little different now. Augie's not just the guy that pushes coins across the counter and has opinions about you know, Brooklyn. He's a guy with the camera and this project that he calls his life's work. So, in a way, even just that, doesn't it open his eyes? A little bit like I asked everyone to, you know, not leap to theologizing, or and nothing wrong with theology, but it's a step for later to just look with fresh eyes. The first response to the film clips today was from a little girl, the first one we heard. And that's, the more you can just look at something, just hear it, just take it in, just recognize it, see it new for a minute, the more chance it's going to have to reveal things to you and wake you up, as it does here, doesn't it?
If he hadn't slowed down, he wouldn't have seen his wife.
Probably not. And if he had, would he have been in the place where it would affect him so deeply? It's like, oh, Helen's in here. Oh, I don't want to look at that. You know, or maybe he would have gone home and kind of, oh, that was awkward. But no, it was, yeah.
It's like you were saying, you slow down, you know, you meditate. I mean, even like you were saying, listen to the music or the sounds. I mean, it's the idea of the inhaling of the cigarette. There was another film I watched once, and it was called Castaway, and basically the beginning, right through almost to the end, there's no music. Soundtrack is just the sound in the background, which is an un-Hollywood kind of thing, but it focuses your attention to detail. And it's the same thing here. Just like you say, it just slows it down and you start to pick it up, and we're listening for it at this point, but it happens because of how it was crafted.
And when the music comes in this is just when he slows down and starts to look at the pictures, and very softly this simple little theme comes in.
There's something that ties this one back in with the previous clip, which is that in both cases I think the artist, by slowing down and doing their craft, their art, they learn something about the world. So Andy Goldsworthy talks about how he's learning about the stone. Each time he tries again with this thing, he learns more about the characteristics of stone and how the weight and all that sort of thing, how it works. And Augie, he gets out there every day at 8 o'clock in the morning, takes a picture, and each time, and the more of these photos he takes, the more he learns about his place, just the kinds of shadows that the sun casts at certain in certain weather, and the way people act, the way they relate, that sort of thing. He's learning.
Exactly.
And that's, I've had a friend who writes about that. I know several people have mentioned this, that doing art is not so much a way to tell the world something that you have inside you that you want to reveal to the world. It's a way to learn about the world.
It's something, I just discovered photography a year and a half ago. And that's one of the connections Rosie and I have had as friends, is that she's quite an accomplished photographer, and she's given me some little seminars on how to use my cameras and what to do. And people talk about it as a way of, you know, of expressing yourself. And I think it's exactly wrong. There's nothing in here that I'm expressing. When the camera's there, I'm looking through it at the things out there, just trying to see them and frame them and get them just right and then capture that and Then I go home and look at it on my screen. And maybe I print it out and choose a frame and decide where it should go in the house. Oblation, yes? Take the simple, take a rock. I even take pictures of rocks. I take pictures of what's on the ground in front of me because it catches my eye. And you take a picture and you see something. And you just, it's remarkable. It's not self. It's not showing me off. I get out of the way. I get out of my head when I do that, and I just see the world around me. And it's cleansing and wonderful, an extraordinary thing. Did you notice? Go ahead.
I'll just start. I want to say longing for the power of the relationships in both of those aspects. The man in the relationship with rocks is just overwhelming.
Yes.
The intimacy. And then talking with Paul was just remarkable. Just seeing that was a beautiful thing.
Isn't it?
In both of those, was like, whoa, this is like... just a gift to me to see the months of Idrasis, of the city or the ocean, with this tremendous little relationship with her right there.
And it was an unexpected moment. It's not, let's meet at midnight and I'll show you my pictures. No, Paul wouldn't have gone. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, quite remarkable. Yeah, you talk about the quality of attention that he has to the rock. That's a remarkable thing. I think that's part of the way that the Holy Spirit's involved in the work of an artist, is this quality of completely paying attention, completely attending. Because, God's Spirit is breathed into creation, moves over the face of creation, and there's something about tuning to that, I think, when you pay close attention. You touched on the fact that creation is in both of these pieces. You talked about the weather and the river. Did you notice in the first piece the way that the water rose and fell, the way the plants in the glade rose and fell? And if you think about it, that the plants are on a 12-month cycle, right? From the morning, springtime when they come up, through the nighttime when they go down and die in the winter. And there's the tide on a 12-hour cycle, rising and falling. And they capture that by showing us these things relating. And then he talks about the weather changing. The angle of the sun is a little different every day.
He's on a cycle too. He's on a 24-hour cycle. 8 o'clock every morning he's up there taking his picture.
Yeah, and each day the angle of the sun is a little bit different. The weather's different. And interesting to me that these holy moments in both cases have to do with nature. In the second case, in a very urban setting. But there's still this touch of God's created order in the context of what man has created, is creating, is going to create. So there's lots more there, but we'll keep moving. I'll introduce you to a couple more characters here. Ricky has just moved into the neighborhood. He's an odd fellow in the high school who has video camera, and he videotapes everything. He walks home and he sees a dead bird by the road, and he videotapes the bird. He's talking to two girls, and so he just has the camera on them, and he videotapes things. But when the two girls he's talking to say, "That's weird, could you put that away?" He just does. He puts it away. And then he meets Jane. Jane was one of those two girls who lives next door to where he's just moved in. And so they start becoming friends a little bit, but it's very tentative, and he's rather odd. She comes over, and he actually shows her his father's collection of Nazi memorabilia. And she's looking rather oddly, as you're going to see in a moment. And then he says, "You're afraid of me, aren't you?" "No, no." And you'll see what happens here. The film's called American Beauty. What did you see? What did you notice?
Notice the color of the late bag against the red bricks.
Quite striking, wasn't it? And then the brown gold leaves kind of clustered at the bottom.
And the black, almost completely black, of their faces and the room that they were in. That the only light that you could see pretty much at all is what they were looking at on the screen.
normally, you know, it's in a theater or on another screen, you see more of them, but it's still very dim. And I actually love the fact that as dim as this was, you saw in his eyes, you saw reflected the image that they were watching on the screen. It was that. That's how much the light came from that source.
What I heard was, there's so much beauty in this world. If we could, with the eyes for it, to see it.
Yeah. And when he says that, his heart's so full, isn't it?
One of my favorite things of always is the dust devil, to see, you know, when the invisible becomes visible for a moment. That's a beautiful thing. You just realize the curtains around us that you can't really imagine are there at all. It's crazy. Little gnats occurred.
Yeah.
This dust, or a schoolyard. Our whole middle school were out on the field one day at the end of the summer, or before summer, and this dust devil came down and touched and started picking up debris. And I'm convinced 600 kids all stopped with glee to watch this crazy little dance as the thing went across our entire field.
And
chasing it and frolicking.
And yeah, it he says here, it was like it was asking me to dance with it.
Yeah.
And you're right, the visible, the invisible made visible. Wind isn't a thing. Wind is air. That now it's moving, but the air is there all the time. It's just that right now it's moving in a particular way because it catches these things in it. We can see it. And so the beauty is there. The beauty is there just when the air is there, and now something happens. Oh, I never thought of this, but it's really what the wind does. And of course we know what the wind, how the wind resonates for the Hebrews in the Old Testament, the Ruach, the spirit. But the wind picks up, takes up, lifts up this bag, doesn't it? That's interesting. Never thought of that before. What else? Yes?
In all three clips, I saw the manipulation of the director and the producer.
Mm-hmm.
I just realized we saw precisely what they designed they would want to see us, have us see. Second clip. In one moment, I was laughing when he produced the second book. Mm-hmm. 72 seconds later, I did this, but I didn't want anybody to see, the moment of the movie producer when they can evoke tears for me, when he saw his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And I cried along with him. But it was all manipulated. You know, the producer is so good at his art or her art that they can take my emotions and make them do precisely what they want to do. And I thought, you know, the third clip for me was a bit too melodramatic, but the second one was perfect. Everyone has a different tolerance.
Right. Yeah.
But the manipulator is the producer, and that's...
manipulation tends to have manipulate hand, you know, that's manipulate, main, you know, French, main is our hand, and to manipulate is to move something, work something with your hand. So we think of manipulate, that's what politicians do to us, that's what dysfunctional people do to try to make us give them more drugs or something. Yes, but it is exactly what a craftsperson does when they take a piece of wood and shape it, they manipulate it. And in a way, we're some of the art that the artist's working on because it's shaping it. Although I will also say that that as an artist, I cannot calibrate what my audience's response will be. Well, yes, we know that if I wait and bring the light cue at that moment on that person, it'll be more moving. It'll, if we take that time with this. So we're constantly manipulating the things in hopes of shaping the thing for the people like us who are experiencing it. But it's not really saying, I'm damn well going to make that person cry. What can I do? What can I do? That's where the manipulation becomes kind of the nasty side of it. But the simple fact is that every artist manipulates, take their hands or their tools, and they shape and they make a thing till it's pleasing. Now, that brings up the question of the recipient of these pieces of art. What was the effect? I'll ask that rhetorically because our time's just about gone. In the third piece, she who was afraid at the beginning sees this thing that he simply offers up like a priest behold, it is good, looks at it. And at the end, she takes his hand. She's been changed. And in the second piece, we've talked about the effect on Paul of what happens to him. Slowing down, seeing these things, and then seeing his wife. And what happens in that relationship with the two of them there in the room. I would ask again rhetorically, is that why the artist did their work? Did Augie go, if I do this someday, Paul's going to get better? You know, did Ricky go, maybe that cute girl that's going to move in a couple months will hold my hand if I show her, if I film this back? That would be manipulative. I don't think so. I'm an artist, and you haven't seen how, well, most of you haven't seen very much of my art, but nobody's seen half my art because I just do it, because I just like it. There were no hits on my blog last week. That's fine. Like, Steve Martin has a great line. He goes, I can do this act alone. I often do. And that's an artist talking, I believe. Now, there's a range of artists. There are artists who are much more people-oriented, and they do this because I want to show people. I want to affect them with this. I saw that. I want them to see it. There's nothing wrong with that. But at one level, the artist is just responding to what's around them. And a playwright is picking up not stones on a beach, not pictures outside their cigar shop or video clip of a bag in the wind. They're picking up people's behavior, the way their mom and dad used to interact at the dinner table. The actor picks up the way that person, go see Meryl Streep in Julie and Julia. Watch how her body moves. There's no other movie where she walks like that. And you'll go, that's one of those wonderful, full of life, older women that's awkward and never played a sport in their life. She just has this kind of, just marvelous. And where did that come from? You know, Meryl Streep just absorbed that, and then it just came out in her work.
In your movie, you're mentioning the artist. It's capturing that moment of epiphany where they suddenly, it's like you were describing this American Beauty, and I was immediately thinking, I remember like a minute worth of that whole film, and that was that moment.
That's the moment.
And so the idea is that, you know, we take in so much through media every day, and yet, you know, you have to sort of, well, prioritize certain events, and that's one of them. And then you're talking about literally down to the service where you're raising the bread and the wine, or that you're transforming that in that instant, and then that's where we're getting these glimpses. I mean, you're giving us these clips, but I'm sure it's the same in the second one as well. There's that one moment, and yet it means everything. The whole film's crafted towards that.
They tend to hinge on these moments.
Yeah.
In this film, I went one matinee in the afternoon. That people had radically mixed responses to American Beauty. Friends, my best movie buddy at that time hated it with all his heart. He thought it was borderline evil. But I just had to go. And I'm sitting there watching the evening going, I like this, this is good. It's a little edgy, it's a little risky, and that scene happened. And I'm sitting in the Silver City Riverport Theater at 2:30 in the afternoon with the half a dozen people late in the run of the film, and it was almost gone from the theaters. And suddenly it was like church on a really good day. It was in God's presence, this sense we don't have to be afraid. There's this life behind things, which of course for me is Jesus, which for me is God's Spirit. I found that astonishing. Just the final note, there's many more things to dig out of here, but I would leave you with this question. And if we talk longer, I'd ask you to talk about these things and hear from each other what this is. But this has been framed sort of in the sense of an artist with this calling. I would put it to you that this is the calling of every created human being, to be this kind of a priest. To see the world around us and to engage with it and to shape it. It's not just artists. Artists are a good example of that because we can see how they do it. But where in your life is oblation? This priestly thing. Where could it be? Where has it been that's been lost in your life? When do you do this? Making things, seeing things, finding, gathering things. Where do you find them? It can be with relationships and people. It could be all kinds of things. And the other thing that I would draw out of this to leave you with, is to go right back to oblation, which happens in the context of the body and blood of Christ, remembering the Last Supper. And it's significant to me that Ricky says, video is a poor excuse, I know. But it helps me remember. I need to remember. And of course, Jesus said, take, eat. Do this in remembrance of me. I was skimming the Old Testament this morning and found places where they would take and build a pile of stones. And then when your children ask you, what are those? You'll remember when we brought the Ark of the Covenant across the river and God stopped the river so it wouldn't be wet. Carve these in your lintel. Tell these stories so we don't forget. Those are mandates for the artist, I think. But in each case, there's this remembrance. And I'll leave you with the last story. I've shown this to a number of people, a number of settings, and we always can see how the artist's work, though they just do it, I believe, for the sake of doing the work, ends up being like a priest who gives the elements in the communion, and people are changed by taking the communion. There's something about this priestly act that ministers to people, that shapes them, that blesses them. And we've wondered how that happens with Andy Goldsworthy. And I showed it to some people from Bowen Island. And I said, you know, I see in these two, but I don't know with Andy Goldsworthy. I don't know. It affects me. But this woman said, oh my goodness. She had a friend whose son, a little boy, was dying of a really rare disease. He was like a 4 or 5 year old boy. And the only place that could treat this syndrome, whatever it was somewhere in Colorado, a hospital, a specialized hospital in Colorado. So she flies in there. You know the disorientation. You fly to a place you don't know. You get to the airport. They go to this place. She takes her boy in, and then that comes the point where he's taken away, you know, for them to work on him. And you can imagine how a mother feels. And she was just churned up and just ripped apart and scared and hopeful. And she goes outside, and there was a garden. She's walking through the paths in this garden. She comes around the corner, and there's this cone of stones. And she just sat there on this bench and just looked at it, and it just everything came to peace for her. She just looked at this cone of stones in the woods, didn't know anything about it, and just found this peace. And that was an Andy Goldsworthy sculpture. That was an emplacement in this kind of sculpture garden there. I thought that brought it full circle for me. Again, this man over in Scotland, who actually now flies around the world, people say, would you come and, you know, mess around in our woods and do something? And so he did. I make theater because I love to make theater, because God made me to make theater, and I delight in telling stories and pretending to be different people and playing around with the lights and the sound and all that stuff. But I don't know if I would still be doing it 25 years later if it didn't just happen that when we put our plays on, people email me and call me and pull me aside and say, oh my goodness, that changed me. That was beautiful. I went in so discouraged, and that lifted me up. Now I understand why. I've always thought gay people were this, but now he's a human being. I still have my ideas and my theology, but it's different for me now. Whatever the story is, stop, listen, pay attention. And I think that secondary thing that happens is why the arts are a priesthood, and why the things you do in your life that are similar to this are priesthood. There we are. I'll give it back to Rosie.
Thank you.